professor at Pepperdine University. He was born in Oklahoma City. He got his bachelor's degree from Stanford, his master's from Fletcher, and his PhD again from Stanford. He's received many awards and fellowships. I'm happy to say one that I have a little connection with, the Institute for the Study of World Politics, but a great many other awards, Warburg, International Studies Association, Brown University, and so on. He was associate director of the Center for Foreign Policy Development at Brown University in the 80s. He's been a fellow at the Arms Control Program at Stanford. He's also been staff assistant in the Executive Office of the President of the United States. He's the author of many books, but three that seem of special interest, American-Soviet Relations, from 1947 to the Nixon-Kissinger Grand Design, Soviet International Behavior and U.S. Options, and then a third book, Henry Kissinger, His Personalities and Policy. Today, we thought it would be very important for us to hear a discussion which he's tried out in several fora. I think he gave a paper at the annual meeting of the American Political Science Association on the subject. He's involved with a group in Washington preparing a volume on treaty ratification with some seven case studies. And therefore, it's not a subject where he simply stumbled in from the street to tell us about what he's going to talk about. It is a long-term interest. And the subject is SALT II ratification, debate, and domestic politics. It's a great pleasure to have Professor Caldwell with us.
Thank you. Well, let me, in good Chinese fashion, pay my compliments to Professor Thompson and the Miller Center. I have great respect for Professor Thompson's work. Indeed, I have read it ever since I was in graduate school, so this is the first time we've met face-to-face, though we've had some correspondence and telephone conversations and things like that, so it's my pleasure to be here and to meet him face-to-face. I would like to talk some about a research interest that I've had for the last 3 years. When I was getting ready to go on sabbatical 3 years ago, I started looking around for a topic, as we professors are wont to do when faced with that decision as to what to do in order to get a sabbatical year off. So I looked around, and indeed I had been interested in arms control for a number of years, and in the SALT II agreement in particular. And so I started looking around to see if anyone had studied the SALT II ratification debate. And indeed, I was quite surprised to find three fairly good books on the Panama Canal Treaty's ratification debate, but no books on the SALT II ratification debate. Strobe Talbot, who is probably the preeminent chronicler of SALT, had written a book called Endgame, The Inside Story of SALT II. And Endgame concluded with the signing of SALT II, and he wrote another book called Deadly Gambits, and that was Arms Control Inside the Reagan Administration. So there was that gap in Talbot's treatment of arms control, as well as academics' treatment of SALT II. So I focused on the SALT II ratification debate, and then separately, a friend, mutual friend of Professor Thompson's and mine, named Michael Crapon, and I found ourselves as roommates in the Soviet Union 6 years ago. And we have similar interests in arms control, and we talked about the topic that we're focusing on today of treaty ratification in the arms control area. And neither of us knew anything of substantial treatment, of book-length treatment, that focused on the subject. So we started our conversation about this subject 6 years ago, and then about a year ago got a grant from the Ford Foundation to study comparative treaty ratification debates in this century in the United States. And we're focusing on seven cases, as Professor Thompson mentioned. We're focusing on the Versailles Treaty, the Washington Naval Treaties of the 1920s, third, the Geneva Protocol. It was first proposed in 1925 and finally ratified in 1975, a 50-year hiatus there of a ratification debate. Then fourth, the Limited Test Ban Treaty of 1963. Fifth, SALT I. Sixth, SALT II. And seventh, and most recently, the INF, the Intermediate Nuclear Force Treaty. We had a meeting of our case study authors yesterday, so I come to you fresh with hopefully some insights from that meeting, and we will conclude that project in January. So the comments that I will make will focus on the first of those research endeavors, on my own work on SALT II, though I will at the end of my presentation make some comments about sort of lessons to be learned for treaty ratification from this case that perhaps applied to some of those other cases that I mentioned in the second endeavor, the Stimson Center Treaty Ratification Project. With that introduction, let me focus on really five different topics in thinking about SALT II. And those five topics are the international context of the treaty ratification debate, secondly, the domestic political context, third, the role of the president, and fourth, executive congressional relations, and lastly, public opinion and the role of interest groups. And I would add, this is the framework that we have used in analyzing those seven cases that I mentioned to you a few minutes ago. The data for my own research comes essentially from three different sources. First are from memoirs of the participants in the SALT II treaty ratification debate. President Carter, Secretary of State Vance, National Security Affairs Advisor Brzezinski have all published their memoirs, so there are significant memoir material available to researchers. Also, the secondary accounts, such as Talbot's, as well as others, constitute part of that sort of bibliographic data. Secondly, I have used the archives. This is atypical for some modern political scientists, but I was trained in history as an undergraduate, and the reason that I wound up in political science is that I went to my advisor as an undergraduate, Carl Daigler. I said, "Professor Daigler, I don't know if I want to study history or political science. Which should I study?" And he looked at me and said, "You really don't care." I said, "Well, I like both subjects, and I don't have a strong preference." So he kind of shook his head and he said, "Well," he said, "you should know that political scientists come a dime a dozen, but historians come even cheaper." So that's with apologies to any historians in the crowd, but I find that I'm now a political scientist doing history without a real license, so please don't charge me with practicing without a legitimate license here. But as I say, atypically for some political scientists, I went to the archives. I spent time at the Carter Center and the Carter Library, and fortunately for my purposes, much of the material that I was interested in was not classified, because the memos from Gerald Rafshoon or from Jody Powell or Hamilton Jordan to the president did not mention specific numbers mentioned in the negotiations and so on. So some of the memos that I read were marked in big letters for the president's eyes only and that sort of thing, but they had no national security classification, top secret or secret, whatever. So there was some very good data at the archives. I also went to the Henry Jackson papers, which were opened about 2 years ago at the University of Washington. And because those papers do not have the attention that the presidential papers have, it was similar to looking for the proverbial needle in the haystack. I was, for example, looking for a 23-page single-spaced memo that Henry Jackson and his then-assistant Richard Perle sent to President Carter in February 1977. The librarian sort of pointed over at some boxes and said, well, good luck, Professor Caldwell. There they are. So I went at these boxes for about 4 days, and I, in fact, found the 23-page memo I was looking for in some obscure file. I also found Richard Perle's mortgage papers, which were also interesting. I can tell you how much he paid for his house in Washington, D.C., some things like that. I discovered some of the secret joys of archival research. The third source of my data for the study that I have concluded on SALT II consisted of 72 interviews. Those interviews were with people from the top down, President Carter, President Ford, Secretary of State Vance, and on down to those who were manning the trenches in the Department of State, and then some in the Senate who were working on Senate committees and so on. So I have a rather rich source of data for some of the things that I will be saying, and I'll try to tap into some of that data that has not come out previously in my presentation. As far as the international context of SALT II, you'll probably all recall that the SALT II Treaty was signed in June 1979. It was signed in Vienna between President Carter and Leonid Brezhnev. President Carter returned to Washington and, taking a page out of President Nixon's book, flew immediately from Andrews Air Force Base to the Capitol, where he made a presentation on the SALT II Treaty that had just been concluded. Then, following his presentation to the Congress, the treaty was submitted to the Senate according to the constitutional requirement that all treaties be submitted to the Senate for its advice and consent. So during the summer of 1979, three Senate committees considered the treaty: Foreign Relations, Armed Services, and the Intelligence Committee. And the treaty emerged from those hearings in relatively good shape by the end of the summer. I'll come back to that in a moment, but that's, I think, an important point to keep in mind, that the vote in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee was 9-6, not a two-thirds vote, but nevertheless a substantial majority in favor of the treaty. So let me return to that in a moment and talk about some of the reasons that SALT II was not ratified. As far as the sorts of events that one can think about in an international sense surrounding the treaty, recall that President Carter was inaugurated less than 2 years after the fall of South Vietnam. And one of the Carter administration officials I interviewed said that the context that SALT II was debated in was essentially a time that represented an opportunity for the Hawks to have their revenge. South Vietnam had fallen. The SALT I agreements, the ABM Treaty, the Interim Agreement on Offensive Forces had been concluded in 1972. Many of those on the conservative side of the political spectrum were quite concerned about the kind of leftward, in their view, the leftward turn by Nixon and Kissinger. And consequently, there was that concern domestically. The Soviet buildup was a fact, and that concerned many Americans as well, because the Soviets were building up their military forces both in a nuclear sense as well as in a non-nuclear sense. So a number of conservatives as well as moderates were quite concerned about that Soviet buildup. There were other Soviet actions throughout the world that concerned people as well. Soviet and their surrogates, the Cubans, their actions in Africa, in both Southern Africa as well as the Horn of Africa. And so these were some of the international events that concerned people. The domestic political context. First, let's think about the executive branch itself for a moment. The Carter administration foreign policy team, as you again will recall, was divided at the top. The Secretary of State believed one thing about Soviet-American relations, and the National Security Affairs Advisor, and Dr. Brzezinski, believed something else about Soviet-American relations. That was ironic, since each man had recommended the other to President Carter for the position he wound up in. That is, Carter had asked Cyrus Vance what Dr. Brzezinski should be appointed to, and Vance said, well, the NSC. And Carter then asked Brzezinski what he thought Cyrus Vance should be appointed to, and he said, well, a man with Vance's stature and experience and so on should certainly be Secretary of State. So the resulting conflict between the two men, I think, is, in retrospect, ironic, given that particular set of circumstances. That conflict between Vance and Brzezinski was not just a personality conflict, it was a conflict of the way that the United States should deal with the Soviet Union, and a conflict of priorities. For example, Cyrus Vance believed that the United States should place emphasis on concluding arms control agreements with the Soviet Union. And Zbigniew Brzezinski believed that the United States should put first priority on containing Soviet influence and expansion throughout the world. And when those two objectives came in conflict, it was natural that Vance would say, well, arms control should be delinked from Soviet adventurism throughout the world, and that Brzezinski would say, no, we should stop the Soviets and then worry about arms control secondly. So that conflict was never resolved in the Carter administration, and many observers have pointed out that President Carter would have been better off to choose one view or the other, but not try to go through his 4 years as president trying to select some from Brzezinski's view and some from Carter's view. Recall some of the speeches that President Carter gave. You could almost see the scissors marks where he'd take the draft from Vance's shop and the draft from Brzezinski's shop and try to dovetail them together. I recall, for instance, the commencement address President Carter gave at the Naval Academy as being one example of that. As far as Carter's relations with other prominent individuals in American politics, this came out in my research at the Carter Library. There was probably no single individual to whom President Carter sent personal messages, at least that I saw in the research that I did at the Carter Library, than Henry Jackson, the senator from Washington, the acknowledged expert on defense in the Senate, who had played a central role in arms control treaty ratification debates dating back to 1963 with the Limited Test Ban Treaty. Carter felt like if he could get Jackson's support, that SALT II and indeed his policies in the energy field would have much smoother sailing through the Senate. So I found innumerable handwritten notes from President Carter to Senator Jackson saying things like, Scoop, I just wanted to wish you happy birthday, or Scoop, please wish your daughter happy birthday for me. Personal invitations to go to the Kennedy Center with the President, Mrs. Carter. So I think there was a real attempt by President Carter to win Henry Jackson over to his side in trying to gain support for SALT as well as other aspects of Carter's legislative priorities. Another individual I'll mention who was very important in retrospect was Paul Nitze. One of the people I interviewed for my book said that Paul Nitze was the first person he knew to have a Jimmy Carter bumper sticker on his car, which came as a big surprise to me. Nitze is a Democrat, but a conservative Democrat, I think as all of you realize. He advised President Carter early in the campaign, but he went with a group of defense advisors to see President Carter in Plains. And Mr. Nitze presented a very hard line. And apparently President Carter did not want to hear this, and so he did not call on Mr. Nitze again. And of course, Mr. Nitze went on to become central in probably the most influential interest group in the treaty ratification debate. That was the Committee on the Present Danger. So there were some personality aspects of all of this, and let me turn next to the role of the president, President Carter himself. President Carter's popularity, and it's actually a rather sad story. I brought some public opinion data here, which let me pass around. Unfortunately, I don't have enough for everyone, but perhaps you can get an idea of this, and I'll show it to you here. But you can see the sad history of President Carter's popularity, starting relatively high at the beginning of the administration, up around 70%, going up to 75% in March 77, and then goes down from there with a jump up at the very end of the administration. For any number of reasons, President Carter's popularity declined, and I won't go into that, but let me point out that the President Carter had limited political capital that he could spend. No president, not even President Reagan, has unlimited political capital. It's a limited resource. Now, some presidents have more political capital, have more money in the bank, if you will, than others. And I think Reagan is an example of a president who had more political capital than certainly Jimmy Carter. But Carter chose to spend part of that political capital on a treaty that came before SALT II, namely, or treaties, I should say, the Panama Canal treaties. And in making that decision, that may have been a key decision for SALT II, because he did some arm twisting, put pressure on moderate senators to vote in favor of the Panama Canal treaties. I'll mention two cases in point. Both Senator Stone, conservative Democrat from Florida with a large Cuban emigre population, felt great pressure to vote against the Panama Canal treaties, and because of pressure from President Carter, he voted in favor. The other example was even more important than Senator Stone, and that was Senator Howard Baker, a moderate Republican, the minority leader of the Senate, and indeed it was Senator Baker's father-in-law who provided support that was key to getting an earlier treaty ratified, the Limited Test Ban Treaty, and of course his father-in-law was Senator Everett Dirksen. With Baker's support, Carter felt like SALT II would have been in good shape, but Baker had voted in favor of the Panama Canal treaties, and he told President Carter, Carter thanked him profusely, and Baker told Carter in response, well, thank you very much, but I can't vote with you like this too often, because that will put me in real trouble with my constituency. And indeed, Baker then ran for the presidency, as you'll recall, in 1980, and by the time SALT II was considered, he was involved in the campaign for the Republican presidential nomination and came out against SALT II. Now, the Panama Canal Treaty ratification debate was important for another reason, and that is that in the Panama case, the administration worked out its approach to dealing with treaty ratification. And it tailored that approach just as it had done in winning the election. Jimmy Carter and his crew from Georgia can be criticized for a lot of reasons. But one of those reasons is not winning the 1976 presidential election. Well, first winning the nomination, and then secondly winning the election. Recall in 1974 and 1975, even in 1975, a year before the election, Jimmy Carter was referred to as Jimmy Who. And he went from almost being unknown to the American public to winning the Democratic nomination and the election. So Carter's people were very good at winning elections. Hamilton, Jordan, Jody Powell, and the others were good at election campaigns. So they came up against this campaign to win the public support for the Panama Canal treaties, and they ran it like an election campaign. They had people, influential citizens, come to Washington where they met with President Carter, and they, in essence, turned public opinion around on Panama, and the Panama Canal treaties were ratified by one vote. So that then became the template for the SALT II ratification debate, I think with some disastrous results, as we'll talk about in a moment. To look at executive congressional relations for just a moment. In a word, executive congressional relations in the Carter administration were terrible. Things got off to a bad start from day one. Tip O'Neill, the then Speaker of the House, went to an inaugural party at the Kennedy Center, and he had told Hamilton Jordan that he needed X number of tickets for his wife and his family members, and he says that when he appeared on the stage with President Carter, he was looking for his family members in the first rows, indeed even in the orchestra section of the Kennedy Center, and he looked and he couldn't see them and just assumed that he had missed them. Well, it turned out that they were in the last balcony and one of the last rows of the Kennedy Center, and Tip O'Neill and had no love lost from day one then for Hamilton Jordan. The Office of Congressional Relations in the White House. Almost uniformly, in the interviews I conducted with senators and staff members in the Senate, was given bad marks. Apparently the office just was not used to dealing with senators. Most of those who staffed the Office of Congressional Relations came with President Carter from Georgia. They didn't have Washington experience. They didn't know the arcane ways that Washington and the U.S. Senate operate. And consequently, that was a bad aspect of all of this. As far as public opinion and interest groups, not surprisingly, the public didn't know much about SALT. Let me just convey two public opinion polls that illustrate that quite dramatically. In December 1978, this was about 7 months before the treaty was signed, only 34% of those questioned could identify the two countries negotiating the SALT talks. So if you knew in 1978 that it was the United States and the Soviet Union negotiating, you were in the elite of American public opinion. You were in the top third. And congratulations to those of you who knew that. In May 1979, this was just 1 month before the SALT II treaty was signed, 2% identified SALT as, quote, the most important issue for the Congress to do something about. Talking to people who were speaking to groups throughout the United States, they say people just were not concerned about the threat of nuclear weapons and so on. I think that took some loose rhetoric on the part of President Reagan's administration. Edwin Meese saying things like nuclear war is something we may not want to have and some things like that, that caused people to get quite concerned. Now, Carter, in following the polls on SALT II, and those of you who have the polls that I passed out can see this, in page 2 of the polls, and I have two copies of my APSA paper here as well. Maybe I can distribute some of those. To get a few more copies of this. Let's see. One of the public opinion groups pointed out that the polls, P-O-L-L-S, on SALT II are polls, P-O-L-E-S, apart. And figure 2 in the handout, and the figure that I'm passing out in this paper, I think illustrate that quite clearly, that these public opinion polls on SALT II were literally all over the map. And you can see that quite clearly, that the Harris and NBC polls are indicating from 65% to 75% support for this, and other polls were indicating, well, in the case of Committee on the Present Danger, 20% support. So these polls really did not tell President Carter a lot, or conversely, could tell him what he wanted to see. He depended, again, going along with my observation about the way that he ran the SALT II ratification campaign, he depended upon his election pollster for in-house White House polls, and that was Pat Caddell. He's a young, brash Harvard graduate who did a very good job of doing polls during the election, got to the White House, and I read the polls that Caddell was sending President Carter. And he was sending President Carter saying that there was this American public opinion reaction to Vietnam. People didn't want to get involved internationally, that they were anti-defense spending and so on. Meanwhile, other polls, not Caddell's polls, but Gallup and others, were indicating that American public opinion was turning around, and that the so-called Vietnam syndrome was really playing less of a role in the late 1970s. And finally, in 1978, I found a memo that Mr. Caddell sent to President Carter saying, I've discovered this amazing trend in American public opinion. My latest poll, the American people are in fact becoming more pro-defense. The Vietnam syndrome is becoming less important, and so on. Well, other polls had been saying that for several years before Pat Caddell discovered that, but President Carter was listening to Pat Caddell and not paying attention to these other polls. So public opinion is an interesting part of the story, and I can return to that question time if you'd like me to. As far as interest groups, played a key role in the SALT II case. As I mentioned, the Committee on the Present Danger was the group that was targeted at the elite of American public opinion. Mr. Nitze wrote about, I think it was 14 versions of a very technical, detailed assessment of the SALT II treaty and how it affected the Soviet-American strategic balance. And that was distributed to opinion leaders, to editors, to professors, others all across the country. And that played a very important role in the debate. Another group, the American Security Council, was targeted on the mass public. And they weren't so concerned about distributing these detailed analyses for experts that the Committee on the Present Danger was producing. But the American Security Council produced several films, the most important of which was called The SALT Syndrome. It was shown over 700 times in the United States. It was a 30-minute film, very well done from a technical point of view, technical in the sense of convincing people to the anti-SALT position. In fact, the Carter administration thought that it was so effective that it issued a published rebuttal to the SALT syndrome, sort of taking the points raised by the SALT syndrome one by one. But of course, the average American who had seen this on television was not going to be interested in this point-by-point rebuttal. And so the administration and the pro-SALT II supporters really never had an effective counter to the SALT syndrome. That's part of the disturbing side of the SALT II ratification story, in my point of view. Just as in political campaigns, I'm concerned about the decreasing emphasis on a consideration of issues and an increasing emphasis on television, 30-second spots, and that sort of thing, where people don't think so much about the issues as they react to images on television, radio, or whatever. Well, conclusions. You know, we've looked at these five different areas now of the international political context, the domestic political context, the role of the president, executive congressional relations, And finally, public opinion and interest groups. First question, the most obvious, why wasn't SALT II ratified? Well, first, I think there were some shortcomings of President Carter and his administration. There were some shortcomings in the appointments he made. The Vance-Brzezinski split, some appointments that he didn't make, for instance, appointing Paul Nitze to some kind of position in the administration where Mr. Nitze would have been the supporter of arms control that he became in the Reagan administration. And there were some other appointment problems, the White House Office of Congressional Relations that I've already mentioned. Second, SALT II was not ratified because of indifferent public opinion. It took the American public to perceive a danger from the threat of nuclear war for the American public to get involved in the issue. And that happened with, as I say, some loose rhetoric from American governmental officials, and then a kind of grassroots movement that focused on the freeze movement in 1982. A third, interest groups. The opposition interest groups in the SALT II debate were far more effective, they were better financed than the pro-SALT II interest groups. And I think the opposition groups recognized the way that public opinion was going. That is, in my view, the Committee on the Present Danger and the American Security Council did not turn American public opinion around. That's a task that's akin, and again, in my analogy, to turning an enormous oil tanker around. I mean, that's a very difficult job, time-consuming, and so on. I do think the opposition groups, however, recognized the way that public opinion was going and capitalized on that. And clearly President Carter, relying on the polls of Pat Caddell, did not. There was a sequencing mistake. I've mentioned going with Panama Canal first meant that President Carter spent some valuable political capital on getting the Panama Canal treaties ratified, and that capital could have been spent on SALT II. And lastly, it was a mistake to try to win over some members of the Senate. And in fact, in my interview with President Carter, he said that he thought he had a chance with Henry Jackson, but that in retrospect, with Richard Pearl as one of Jackson's principal advisors, he probably had close to zero in terms of a chance of winning over Senator Jackson. Well, the irony of all of this is that despite all of these mistakes that I've mentioned, SALT II, as I said at the beginning of my presentation, probably would have been ratified if a vote had been taken at the end of August 1979. But three international events occurred that really drove the nails in the coffin of SALT II. Those three events: first, the discovery of a combat brigade of Soviet troops in Cuba at the end of August 1979. It was announced by none other than the chairman of the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee at that time, Frank Church. A liberal Democrat rings the alarm bell about the Soviet combat brigade in Cuba. So that was the first of these international events. Secondly, and only tangentially related to SALT II, in early November, the so-called Iranian students took over the American embassy in Tehran. And as I say, that was tangentially related to SALT II because we had some listening posts in Iran that enabled us to monitor some Soviet missile tests. So it did have some relationship to SALT II, but more importantly, it raised questions about President Carter's competency to lead foreign policy. And so that raised some more questions. And of course, finally, in late December 1979, the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan. And in response to that, in early January, the president withdrew the SALT II treaty from the Senate's consideration. So it was for those three international events that SALT II was not ratified. And the last question that I'll briefly address is, so what? What difference did that make? Well, I think given the turnaround in Soviet American relations that we witnessed in the last half of the 80s, perhaps it didn't make all that much a difference. On the other hand, had SALT II been ratified and had President Reagan come into office with a more moderate approach to the Soviet Union, it's conceivable that we would be even further along in reducing the 50,000 nuclear weapons that the United States and the Soviet Union have between them than we are today. So I think it did make some difference, and that opportunities once presented often cannot be recaptured. And it took us essentially a decade to recapture some of the opportunities that were there in 1979 that were not captured for the reasons that I've outlined. And that's the end of my formal comments, but I'd be glad to try to respond to questions that you might have on things that I've mentioned.
Good. I would like to ask the first question. Yes, Henry Theobald.
With your background and the experience with the SALT II, what do you think the odds are in the start?
I think they're very good, partially because there's a Republican president. Republican presidents have easier times with arms control agreements than Democrats. And then secondly, I think with the INF Treaty, that arms control is now a kind of bipartisan issue, and that both Republicans and Democrats, particularly in light of the Reagan administration's support for arms control during the second term, that this is a legitimate thing for both Republicans and Democrats to support. So I think there will be a fight from people like Jesse Helms, Malcolm Wallop, and others in the Senate, but I don't expect it to be debilitating to the START agreement. The CFE agreement is another one that I think will be passed as well.
General Kidd?
May I follow that one up over on that subject? I wanted to home into that one too. Two parts, when might we expect a START agreement, and will the agreement be worth all of the effort over X number of years, quite a few years, you know better than I when it started, since some studies show that we're going to end up with like 88% of present strategic weapons as compared to the advertised 50, then 40% reduction.
As to the first part of the question, when do I expect a START agreement, I was a lot more confident in answering that question prior to August the 2nd and Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait. That has obviously dominated the attention of the president and his closest advisors. Nevertheless, the START negotiations are continuing, though there have been some obstacles that have come up in the negotiations even in the last several weeks. So nevertheless, I expect some kind of a START agreement, I would say, by the spring or the summer of 1991.
Excuse me. The last promise I heard was by the end of this year, so that's already slipped.
Yeah.
Excuse me for
interrupting. No, that's quite right. That was what Gorbachev and Bush agreed to. Now, I think, though, that they can quite legitimately point to events in the Persian Gulf and say we've had some other things to worry about. But predictions are dangerous for me to make. They'll probably conclude the agreement tomorrow after this answer. Secondly, as to what difference a START agreement would make, I look at arms control as an incremental process. It is a process that is taken a step at a time and is rarely taken with a big jump. There are some historical cases where big jumps have been taken successfully. Washington Naval Treaty is an example of that, though we could argue about the success or the failure of that. But nevertheless, Secretary of State Charles Evans Hughes presented a dramatic proposal, and the great powers at that time accepted it. There was an attempt to take a great step during the Carter administration in March 1977, when Secretary of State Vance went to Moscow and presented a so-called deep cuts proposal. And for a number of reasons, Soviets rejected it immediately and vociferously. So if that's the case, if these kinds of arms control in leaps and bounds don't often work, which I believe to be the case, then the incremental approach is more successful. And I think that START represents that kind of an incremental step, where it won't do away with the 50% of our nuclear weapons and Soviet nuclear weapons, but it will continue the reduction process that was begun with the INF Treaty, and this will apply for strategic weapons.
Next, Professor Fernbach.
Pardon me. To what degree do you see a linkage, not just between regional political conflicts and arms control, but between the whole process of accommodation and confidence building?
Well, that's a great question. I have been talking with friends in Washington the last several days, other political scientists largely, and we've been talking about what an interesting time this is in world history, not just American history or anything else. I think that we're living in a period now that's akin to those odd periods in world history when change and ferment mark the period, the 1770s and 1780s, 1848, the post-World War II era, 1945 to 1950, where international relations and the assumptions of international relations are sort of open to question. And I think the same now applies to Soviet-American relations. For example, if we were having this meeting even 5 or 6 years ago, but certainly, in my view, prior to March 1985, when Gorbachev came into office, we would be talking about the threat of nuclear war between the United States and Soviet Union as a result of escalation in the Middle East. That's, in my view, the overwhelming good news of the current Middle Eastern crisis, is that we aren't talking about the possibility of Soviet-American conflict. Indeed, we have the Soviets backing up UN resolutions and American actions in the Persian Gulf. So I think to discuss accommodation today is quite different, is very, very difficult to predict.
May I follow up and simply say that you see, to put it the other way, and a period of great insecurity is reflected in drives for larger armaments rather than reduction in armaments.
The one time that I have been disinvited to speak, I hope that none of my comments have offended anyone so deeply here that Professor Thompson will never call me again. But I gave a speech at the Americans for Democratic Action in Los Angeles, their annual meeting. And I never believe in preaching to the choir in speeches that I make. I always try to at least present something that's interesting or provocative. I've tried to accentuate the former here this morning rather than the latter. But at the ADA annual meeting, I thought I would present something provocative, and this was about 5 or 6 years ago. So I presented a thesis that I have that I have dubbed the Dove's Dilemma. And the Dove's Dilemma is this, that if we reduce nuclear warheads, nuclear weapons, and we want the same amount of security, we may very well have to increase defense expenditures, because non-nuclear forces cost a lot more than nuclear forces. So if the level of security that we want is up here, and that's provided by X number of nuclear weapons and Y number of tanks, airplanes, ships, and military personnel,
If we reduce those nuclear weapons, then we're going to have to spend more on those conventional weapons. And so I presented that to the ADA, and the next day I got a call, and I had a speaking engagement a couple weeks later to disarmament group in the Los Angeles area. And this very nice lady said, Professor Caldwell, several of our board members heard you last night, and we don't think we want you to come and speak. So she got me on the wrong day, and I wasn't going to let her off the hook that easily. I said, so you don't want me to present something that you disagree with, or what? I don't quite understand the reason for this. And we went round and round for about 15 minutes. But I think that's the case, that in this new era, the nuclear threat is going to go down, but the conventional threat remains with us. And, you know, I wish I had said that on August the 1st, 1990, the day before the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. Because many commentators were saying it's a new era of peace, you know, what's the role of the military services going to be in the future, and so on. Well, we now know in the Persian Gulf that there is a role for the military in the future, and that sadly some of the events that have occurred in the last 2 years may in fact result in increased turmoil worldwide rather than decreased turmoil. For example, what happens if some of the republics in the Soviet Union break away using force, military force? What's the American response going to be? So there are all kinds of uncertainties that don't just point to a world of peace and a world of decreased tensions in the future.
Next question, Bill Wemple.
Do you think arms control is becoming so increasingly technical and incremental for fear of stirring up and snarling and lunging hounds politically that it's finally going to be beyond the comprehension of the man in the street unless he reads some well-written summary and point of view such as were so well put out by the broadcast by the Committee on the Present Danger. I don't know what that committee is still around, I assume.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a real problem with arms control, and it's a problem that has developed over time. The Limited Test Ban Treaty of 1963 was easy to understand. Indeed, one of the reasons it was concluded is because of the opposition of parents to nuclear testing in the atmosphere, because the bone marrow of children had a higher level of strontium-90. A radioactive isotope that entered the human food chain through atmospheric nuclear testing by the countries that were testing at that time. That was easy to understand. You know, parents say, I don't want my kid to develop leukemia, therefore let's not test in the atmosphere. SALT-1, more complex, but still understandable. You know, it takes some leap of imagination or understanding for people to say, well, we don't want to defend ourselves, which is what the ABM treaty said, but generally people bought that idea. SALT II, tremendously complex agreement. Even though I had followed this from the inception negotiations in November 1969, I got the SALT II treaty, and it took me 2 full working days of going through this and sort of underlining things and scratching my head, coming across new acronyms that I didn't recognize after following the issue for 10 years. One I remember was a FROD, F-R-O-D, Functionally Related Observable Difference. I didn't know what that was until I got a copy of the treaty and tried to figure out what that meant in terms of the treaty. So you're quite right that it has become more and more complex. And I think that the U.S. government officials realized that, and that's one reason that during the Reagan administration there was an emphasis on percentage reductions and things like that that were readily understandable. And that's how I think the administration sold INF, is to say this is the first treaty in history that has reduced nuclear weapons as opposed to just limiting them in some way.
Marshall's around.
To track back a bit, on the, you said SALT II probably would have passed in August of 79, except for those three events later in the year.
Right.
Did it take all three of those to derail SALT II, or would any one of those have been sufficient?
Well, I think the Soviet combat brigade in Cuba was a tempest in a teapot, is the phrase that was mentioned quite a bit in some of the interviews that I had. That was with Carter administration officials. But let me cite evidence from the other side. I had an interview with Senator Garn, who was no friend of the treaty, to put it mildly. He was one of the strongest and most vociferous opponents of the treaty. And I asked him about the Soviet combat brigade in Cuba in retrospect, and he said, well, at the time we considered it a big deal and we used it for our purposes, but in retrospect it was really not that important. So I think that over time, let's say the fall of 1979, that issue would have been dealt with. In fact, some of the accounts on the brigade that have been published since then indicate that the brigade in fact was in Cuba since 1962, since the Cuban Missile Crisis. So I think that would have been dealt with during the fall. So I don't think that would have been sufficient. The Iranian hostage crisis, I think, probably would have, because it dealt such a severe blow to President Carter's credibility and his leadership of foreign policy, that I think that would have been sufficient. And then, of course, we know Afghanistan was in fact, the event that caused President Carter to withdraw it from the Senate's consideration.
Any other questions? Howard Cromwell?
Following up on that, was Vance's resignation connected, which was connected with the Iran hostage thing, was that also a contributing factor to Carter's loss of control on this treaty?
I think that his Secretary of State Vance resigned over principle over the attempted rescue of the hostages in Iran.
Yeah, yeah.
He found out about the hostage rescue attempt and he went to President Carter and told him that he opposed it in the strongest possible terms, and that if President Carter went ahead with the hostage rescue attempt, whether it succeeded or failed, he would resign from office. The president chose to go ahead, the rescue attempt failed, and Secretary of State Vance still resigned. From my reading of the memoirs, and I in fact interviewed Secretary of State Vance, I don't think that his resignation was related to SALT II. I think there was some element of frustration in fighting these battles with Brzezinski all the time and winning some and losing some. And toward the end of the administration, he was losing more than winning. So I think that was a possible element, but the hostage rescue attempt was the event that catalyzed his resignation.
I didn't mean that so much, but the very fact you lost his Secretary of State seemed to have lost him a trump card in trying to put something else here.
Well, recall that he then put ex-Senator Muskie in as Secretary of State, I think partially to try to win some points from the Senate, in that one of their own was Secretary of State. Muskie felt strongly on the issue of arms control. He could provide some advice about how to get it through the Senate and so on.
Professor Fernbach?
Following up on that, I'd like your evaluation looking at not just this case, but all seven case studies or any other of the foreign policy background that you have, as to whether there is an advantage, and if so, what, in including members of the Senate in the negotiating process itself.
Yeah, in some of the other cases, this has been done. Washington Naval Treaty case, for example, several senators were actual members of the negotiating delegation, which turned out to be quite successful in terms of getting the Senate's approval of the Washington Naval Treaties. The Carter administration, well, indeed, really from the time of SALT, the inception of SALT II on, there has been a congressional observer group at the SALT negotiations. And the Carter administration made valiant attempts to try to include members of the Senate and the Congress as observers and testifying before Congress and so on. But I think this sense that the President Carter actually encouraged, that his administration was from outside of Washington and that it was not a part of Washington, which was part of the electoral strategy, that got in the way of his later attempts to try to influence the Congress. Yeah, so I think that was the more important factor than giving senators some airplane tickets to go to Geneva to watch the negotiations.
Michael Quirin.
If we somewhat accept the fact that we're in a post-Cold War world and that future conflicts will be not necessarily one superpower against the other, but will be in the third world, or maybe you could say offshore, that will involve the superpowers, and that these conflicts will be conventional, and there will be no room for even the threat of nuclear weapons. Does this mean, in your opinion, that perhaps the United States and maybe NATO will have to reevaluate the value and the place of nuclear weapons in our security plan?
Oh yeah, I think definitely so, and indeed the United States has already brought home a lot of its nuclear weapons from Western Europe. So I think undoubtedly that will be the case, but at the same time, nuclear weapons are in the arsenal of the United States. They are in the Persian Gulf right now, in my view, on Navy ships, and are probably in contingency plans in response to potential use of chemical weapons by Saddam Hussein. So undoubtedly there's going to be a lot of rethinking, because the American tactical and strategic nuclear weapons programs have been geared against the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact primarily. And with the demise of the Warsaw Pact and the demise of the Soviet Union and the Soviet threat, that thinking, rethinking, is going to have to go on most assuredly.
The last question, Victor.
Do you think there will be difficulty in resolving the quality of quantity of sea-based missiles and incorporating that land-based missiles in relationship to the Russians? They believe it should be included in the overall picture. Is that going to be resolved?
You mean sea-launched cruise missiles?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's one of the... Well, there are two types, or actually more types of sea-based nuclear weapons than two, but the two long-range strategic nuclear weapons based at sea are the submarine-launched ballistic missiles, the SLBMs, and then the sea-launched cruise missiles, which always sort of... makes me laugh that to hear some of these acronyms pronounced. Those are the SLCMs, the SLCMs, Sea Launch Cruise Missiles. That has been one of the stumbling points in the SALT II negotiation, because the Navy, the U.S. Navy, wants very much to retain some conventional, that is non-nuclear, sea launch cruise missiles in its inventory. And the question is how can the Soviets, and the Americans for that matter, verify the difference between a nuclear-armed
sea launch cruise missile and a non-nuclear sea launch cruise missile. And so the negotiating party's been going back and forth on that issue, and I don't know how that will come out in the treaty, but that has been one of the big stumbling blocks during the last several years.
General Kidd, this is the last question.
The final question here. Mine's really the penultimate question, but it came out of sequence. Okay? What's wrong with unilateral nuclear disarmament to a degree based on the consideration that some think that we could deter the Soviets with even a small fraction of our present inventory?
We need another seminar for that, but let me take a quick attempt to address some of the important issues. I think there are two aspects of it. One aspect is the objective need for around 30,000 nuclear weapons on the United States side, and as General Kidd points out, many people have said we don't need anywhere near that number. Indeed, during the Kennedy administration, I think it was the whiz kids in the Defense Department under Robert McNamara that concluded that we needed about 200 strategic nuclear weapons, and that if we had twice that many, that is 400, aiming two nuclear weapons at each target so that we'd have high assurance that at least one nuclear weapon would explode on the target, that would certainly be sufficient. And when Secretary of Defense McNamara then went to the President and said, well, all we need is 200 really, but for safety's sake, or for defense purposes, we need 400. And the President said, so we're going to request 400 ICBMs from the Congress. And McNamara's response was, no, we're going to request 1,000. Kennedy shook his head and said, well, why is that? And McNamara's response is, because it's the lowest four-digit number that exists. So that raises the second part of the answer, and that's domestic politics, what we've been focusing on this morning. For domestic political reasons, I think administrations have been very, very hesitant, particularly Democratic administrations, because they're already vulnerable to what used to be the soft on communism charge that carried such weight in American politics. And for domestic political reasons, administrations have been hesitant to do that. Now, in this changed atmosphere that we've talked some about this morning, that may be a new possibility. And indeed, Gorbachev is the one who has announced some unilateral cutbacks rather than the United States. He announced a cutback initially of 500,000 troops, increased that to 1 million. He followed a nuclear testing moratorium for, almost 2 years after he came into office. So we may see more of that, but there is the danger from an American domestic political sense that any president who implements unilateral nuclear arms control with disarmament is vulnerable to domestic political attack as a result of that.
Not only do we promise to invite you back, but as soon as you have another paper as good as this, I will invite you immediately. We had a project one time where somebody was going to interview people at the UN, and the project was framed in the language of anthropology and sociology. It was said they were going to interview the natives at the UN, and there was a lot of other jargon. One very striking aspect of the writings of our guest, but also of his presentation this morning, is the clarity and cogency of what he's explained. All of us have been able to understand what you were saying, and we thank you very, very much.
My pleasure.